Hi everybody, you're listening to bloggingheads.tv. My name is Nikita Petrov, and today's episode features my conversation with Mark Rudd, whose most recent occupation was a mathematics teacher at the community college, but who's better known as one of the founding members of a group called the Weathermen, which later became the Weather Underground organization. Now, the Weather Underground was, by today's standards at least, a terrorist organization. Right, their stated goal was a violent overthrow of the American government. Their method of choice was basically blowing up government buildings. They blew up police cars, police stations. They threw Molotov cocktails at a judge's house once. They blew up the damn Pentagon, right? So that's pretty intense. But there are two things to note here, I think. One, these attacks did not target people, except for one, which didn't happen. It failed. The bomb detonated before it was finished, and it killed the people who were constructing it. And since then, they stayed away from human injuries. They made sure that nobody would be harmed. The other part that I think needs to be mentioned is these were not unique. I have an article from the Time magazine here in front of me, and it says, I quote, "In a single 18-month period, year 1971 and 1972, the FBI counted an amazing 2,500 bombings on American soil, almost five a day," end quote. That was a turbulent time, you know? And, this is how I started the conversation. I asked Mark to talk about that time when it all started, so I think maybe it's a good time for me to stop talking and just let you listen to the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I think it has some relevance for today. Thanks. Talk to you later. So I want to go through the whole history and the story of the Weather Underground and how it began and how it ended. But before we even get to that, I'm hoping that you can help me kind of set the scene and contextualize the roots of that whole thing in the overall ideological, political, cultural landscape of the 60s, because...
Well, I'll try to... That's a complicated story. I wrote a whole book about it.
I understand.
Have you read my book?
I have not. No, I've read some of the writings that you have on the side, and I watched the movie, the documentary about the Weather Underground.
Well,
but I haven't read the book.
The main thing is that I think it's best to tell the story as a personal story. I turned 18 in 1965, and I registered for the draft, and I entered into my freshman year at Columbia University, all in a few months. And it happened to be the moment when the United States invaded Vietnam. So there was a heightened awareness the problem of who the United States was in the world. And as a consequence, when I got to Columbia University, I fell in with students who were already learning about the war in Vietnam and were protesting. They were radicals, meaning that they wanted to get to the root of the problem. One of the things we saw is that there was a global struggle for decolonization and for national liberation. These are technical terms, but remember back in the 1960s, that was the era of decolonization, when the European and American empires were falling apart. So it appeared to us that the United States was engaged in typical great power colonialism, in trying to dominate Vietnam and control Vietnam. Of course, there was the issues of the Cold War, but we also, the group of students I fell in with, believed that anti-communism was one of the main ways in which the consensus for capitalism was maintained. So we decided we were not going to be anti-communist.
Did you see the Soviet Union as another empire that also
we recognize that, but part of the problem was that we saw the Soviet Union as some kind of degenerate communism, but that the real communism was in the Third World, and we tended to idealize countries like China, Cuba, Vietnam. These were countries that were going through decolonization and were still fighting. The Soviet Union had developed. We were very much dominated, I think, by our own brands of Marxism. So we felt the Soviet Union was less of a threat to the world than the United States. And actually, I think if one looks at the whole, you know, at the forces that were arrayed throughout the world, one can come to the conclusion that United States militarism is primary. So at that time, we identified the war in Vietnam as an imperialist war, and we also identified with other struggles such as in Cuba for independence from American imperialism. So we became thoroughgoing radicals in that we opposed American imperialism. We also saw that was an era when civil rights in the United States had become somewhat replaced by a more radical theory called Black Power, and that was also viewed as national liberation. So we had all these great ideas about the era we were living in, and so it seemed to us that you had to choose sides, that you couldn't be in the middle, and you couldn't be you couldn't take a liberal or reformist approach. Now, there had been some incidents, some very important incidents before 65, in which the liberals in the Democratic Party in the United States had betrayed the civil rights movement in the South. And so we decided we didn't want to be liberals. We wanted to be radicals, and we didn't trust liberal solutions. We also didn't want to leave the black radicals, the revolutionaries. They were starting to call themselves revolutionaries. We didn't want to leave them hanging alone. We wanted to provide support. So all of these global and national trends pushed us toward a very radical position, which was that we had to not only end the war in Vietnam, that was not the only goal, but end the system that gave us that war.
And that's before the Weathermen. That's still when you're still in SDS and
yes, I'm early talking about the period from 65 to 68, mm-hmm. in which SDS grew on most all college campuses. Primarily because of the war in Vietnam, but also because of opposition to racism. So that hit a peak in 1968 with the Columbia Revolt, and I was 20 years old, and I was the chairman of the Columbia chapter. So I became identified as the sort of spokesperson of student radicals.
And so when you say and the system, was there like a clear vision of how that needs to happen and what happens after the system is
dismantled?
Well, no, there wasn't. We had a theory that in the course of the struggle, more and more people would join, and we would develop the vision as we went along. But it would be vaguely socialist, and it would be it would follow principles of sharing the wealth and of independence for people around the world, and an end to militarism and racism. So these were kind of generalized notions. Yes.
So maybe this is one place where the story connects to today, because I'm looking at America today. I see a lot of people who are unhappy with Republicans and Democrats, with the Congress and so forth. And I'm very puzzled as to why there's no, I don't see like a real effort to create an alternative within the electoral system that is already in place, like a third party that is not taken as a joke, but can become a force. So you're saying in your time, you were disillusioned with Democrats. You didn't want to be on the side with them. Was there any attempt to create a political body that could work within the system that already has like a way to get in the power?
No, we had images of storming the Winter Palace.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
These were revolutionary. We were revolutionary romantics, and we did not vote. We did not support. Well, by we, I mean the radicals. There were people in SDS who did support liberal reform, especially around the war in Vietnam. But my faction in SDS tended to think that the system was beyond repair, and somehow we convinced ourselves that more and more people would become revolutionary. See, one of the things we believed was that the war in Vietnam, which the United States was obviously losing, was the beginning of the end of the American empire.
Mm-hmm. It did feel like revolutionary times where things are really changing and unraveling.
Yeah. We didn't realize how much life American monopoly capitalism had in it, and we also didn't realize that Vietnam was not representative of the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember, but Che Guevara had put forward the theory that there would be many Vietnams,
right?
We were Guevaristas, is what we were. We were very influenced by the Cuban Revolution, and Cuba, for a brief period of about 18 months, 2 years, believed in the strategy of exporting revolution through guerrilla warfare. The theory was called the FOCO theory.
Mm-hmm.
FOCO meaning in Spanish hearth or nucleus, and it was a theory espoused by Che Guevara in the years prior to his death. He died in 67 in Bolivia, but we were so enamored of the theory that we didn't recognize the total failure of the theory.
So that theory was like the driving force between this movement from SDS to the Weathermen. Do I understand it correctly that within SDS, your faction would like argue with other members, and your position was not at the beginning, at least, was not the most prevalent one?
It's very classic Marxism, in that there's many theories. And especially the theory of revolutionary agent, who will carry through the revolution, right? So we had this theory that it was primarily going to happen from the third world and internally from blacks and other colonized people within the United States, that it would be a national take the form of national liberation struggles like Vietnam or Cuba. instead of worker-led struggles, which would be more classical Marxist. Now, there's another factor in all of this, which was China. And China was anti-Soviet, but had a Maoism postulated the rise of the peasantry. So one of our leading opponents within SDS was a Maoist group that was both classically Marxist in that it talked about the workers, but also pro-China.
Uh-huh.
That was called Progressive Labor Party. So it was this crazy sort of religious internal struggle. You can laugh now because Marxism is completely and totally kaput in Russia, isn't it?
It has its place. The political landscape of Russia is a kind of an interesting story, and it's difficult to translate between the like how Americans and I guess Europe, just the West generally, approaches the subject at all, and how it is in Russia, because in America you have a pretty universally accepted, you know, there's a spectrum there. This is what is called the right. This is what is called the left. This is the spectrum between, and everybody is sort of on the same page as to what these different labels mean. In Russia, none of these labels mean anything. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the 90s, and then when Putin came into power, nobody can point to what Putin's ideology is. And then Putin's current contender, the main like oppositional figure, I think he spends like a quarter of all of his airtime when it's interview time is the interviewer tries to put him on the map somewhere and says, well, you're a nationalist, aren't you? Or here's an example of how your program is a leftist program. And he just gets away out of all of these labels and only tries to talk particularly about this issue or that issue and this issue. So this whole ideological conversation is a conversation that people try to start and then it never actually happens. It's very difficult to put the political forces that we have into different boxes that work for the West.
Well, I'm trying to go back to your question about third party. From time to time, people do attempt third parties, but the system is structured in such a way that it keeps the third parties out. And third parties generally only hurt the party closest to them. So,
right.
So the effect of a third party in the United States would be to solidify Republican rule.
I sort of understand that argument, but I can't say that I buy it completely because, again, if you know, I am shaped by my experience, right? So I'm looking at the Russian situation and the years that led to where we are now, and currently, like that guy, the Alexei Navalny, who is going to try to run for president next year to compete with Putin, he's not allowed to run. There's a criminal case against him, and he's just like the system clearly tells him day after day after day, you're just not going to be allowed to be registered on the ballot. That doesn't stop him from building a movement going from one city to another, and he's gathering these thousands of people in each city, and he has the largest rallies since 91, and build the infrastructure to the point where what he's trying to say is he's trying to create a context in which if there is an election, a presidential election, and he's not in it, then nobody is going to accept that election as a legitimate one. And I don't quite understand why in a country where you can't, there are actually legal ways to register a party and be on this belt or that belt. You can use all of the
under the surface ways. I mean, like, all right, so let's say you're not, you don't get to participate in the big debates, like presidential, let's say, debates between the leading candidates. You still have access to the internet. You still have all the opportunity to build any kind of infrastructure you want.
I understand your point. I suspect that the answer is very simple. It's that enough people haven't become disgusted with the Democratic Party yet.
Mm-hmm.
67 million people voted for Hillary Clinton, and 63 million people voted for Trump. And of the 67 million who voted for Hillary Clinton, many of them don't have serious differences with the Democratic Party. They kind of like the idea of a woman president, right, et cetera, right, et cetera. So among the opponents, there's very little unity. It's so hard in the land of the free. It's so hard to get unity, you know. I would like to see a true social democratic party arise along the lines of Scandinavian social democracy.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
However, all social democracy has in the past has been based on labor and union power, the existence of labor movements. And now we don't have a labor movement. So what do you base your social democracy on?
I saw in one of the, not sure what it was, an essay or an interview that I found on your side, you talk about, you make the distinction between organizing and activism, and you equate one to, well, organizing, building some sort of a structure, connection between people, building a community, and the other with basically self-expression. Is that correct?
Correct.
Sorry, go ahead.
Organizing generally has a strategic goal of power, and you figure out a strategy for gaining power. Self-expression, on the other hand, is what our group fell into. We put a bomb here, we put a bomb there. That's not a strategy for power. It's just expressing ourselves.
Did you feel at the time that this is a strategy for power?
What's that?
At the time when you were using that strategy, did you have the same awareness that you have now?
Yeah, we had a stupid theory. The theory was the Foucault theory. It was a ridiculous theory. It was that action builds a movement, that exemplary action builds a movement. That's how Che Guevara died in Bolivia. They started guerrilla warfare, but they did not spark a movement.
So what was the plan exactly when you were in that weatherman phase? So you're carrying out these actions. So there's a government building blown up there for. And it's like usually, as far as I understand, in response to some action on the part of the American government, right?
The theory was that the mass movement would grow in response to the guerrilla or revolutionary movement.
So you would not be the people building that movement. You were the spark that then inspires other people to.
Correct. Uh-huh. And part of the justification for this theory, or you might call a proof of this theory, was a misunderstanding or a misanalysis, an erroneous analysis of what had happened at Columbia University in 1968. We had gone through a period of more than 3 years before I got there. Early 65 all the way to spring of 68, over 3 years of organizing, of politicizing the campus and getting people to rethink who they were in relation to the problem of the war and the problem of racism. So it was this long period of organizing, which was a part of a, you might call a tradition of the American left, union organizing, civil rights organizing, all the way back to abolitionist organizing. John Brown, for example, was a violent abolitionist, but there were many organizers who talked with people and convinced people way back that they should change their minds. So organizing is a process and a tradition of getting people to rethink who they are. Now, what we misunderstood about Colombia was that it was this long-term organizing that produced the great rebellion of the spring of 1968. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't solely our militancy and our audacity and our willingness to take action. So we understood our own history wrong, but our own history coincided with this theory that was coming out of Cuba called the FOCO theory.
Uh-huh. Okay, that falls in together. Do you have as you look at the various movements in America today, Occupy Wall Street, a few years before now, and then Black Lives Matter and the Antifa, or I guess the alt-right is something that people call a movement now. Do you see the same kind of shift from trying to build structures to a kind of self-expression? Or is that just my perception?
The tendency is always there. Mm-hmm. Because strategy is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out a path to power for a constituency or for a majority even in this country. Who are we? It's hard to define. There are so many conflicting interests, and there's no clear labor organization, for example, unions that become the constituency. Now the Republicans the far right, by comparison, does have a clear base, a popular base. That's the Christian fundamentalist churches. That's who they represent. And that's about 25% of the population. That's Trump's base, believe it or not. That 25% of the population is not going to desert Trump. And they vote.
Okay.
We have
okay.
Nothing comparable. So, in the absence of a clear strategy, then people think that all you have to do is express yourself, and your self-expression will have results. So, if a guy wants to express himself by punching a Nazi in the face, he might think that's a good thing to do because other people will get this great idea that they should go out and punch Nazis.
Uh-huh.
That's not a strategy for power, however. It's more self-expression. Now, self-expression may be necessary at some points within a strategic struggle, but we have yet to develop a strategy for power. That's the problem with the left. The strategy for power may very well be a third party. It could be. There's no reason why I love the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party has to be our strategy. However, we can talk about that. The left does not have a strategy. The right had a good strategy, which was combine ideological conservatives with a Christian fundamentalist base. That's a strategy.
Uh-huh.
And they vote. Uh-huh. And they won. They gained power completely and totally. And in a majority of states, including my own state, New Mexico, where the governor is a Tea Party a member who does not represent more than 25% of the electorate. But since the other people don't vote, she won.
Are there possible projects? So like when you say organizing, to me, the way the word works, if you say organizing, it means you're trying to organize something. There needs to be some sort of a project, some collective work that unites these people. Are there other alternatives that you see? So to me, it seems reasonable, like logical, to have a party, to try to build a party. If not, are there other possibilities that you can point to?
Yes, there are. Lately, a new form of analysis of movements has emerged. It's called, or one element of it is called momentum-driven movements. For example, in 1999, 2000, the Serbs wanted to get rid of Milosevic. Uh-huh. They built a very creative movement, and they got rid of Milosevic. A lot of people joined, but it wasn't a party.
So you're saying there needs to be like a particular goal in sight.
Exactly. Another one was the movement in Egypt to get rid of Mubarak. The democracy movement that did succeed in getting rid of Mubarak was incapable of waging power, right?
Uh-huh.
These are called momentum-driven movements or civil resistance movements. The anti-war movement in the United States, now I'm talking now about the broader movement, not the Weathermen. The Weathermen was was a part of that anti-war movement, but the goal of the anti-war movement as a whole was to end the war in Vietnam. And generally speaking, I think there's good proof that shows that we were successful in ending the war in Vietnam. It was not only the Vietnamese. In fact, the Vietnamese thanked the anti-war movement for helping. So we won. Well, did we have a majority? No. We had millions of people in the streets, but it's still we never elected an anti-war president, and elected an anti-war Congress. So a momentum-driven movement or a civil resistance movement can win a limited goal, but generally speaking, can't gain power. Now, jump ahead 50 years. Right now, we have a momentum-driven movement opposed to Trump. That's all it is, opposed to Trump.
Right.
You know, it doesn't even have a unified goal, impeachment, elect Democrats. There's no unified goal. But still, we have a momentum-driven movement. It's the second time in my lifetime that this momentum-driven movement has appeared. So I'm spending all my time trying to help push that momentum-driven movement, but also to help that movement figure out a strategy for power. Now, the best I can come up with lately is via the Democratic Party. However, there may be a better strategy. One important aspect of this is that the momentum-driven movement has many different goals and many different issues. For example, opposing or stopping global climate change is a mass goal. It's a mass movement, but it has not yet been organized for power. So one of my current theories is that could become the social base. That movement of saving to save the planet could become the social base for a real social democratic movement in the future.
Okay.
The loss of a city of 4 million people, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. You know, the fourth largest city in the United States, finished. It's gone. They'll rebuild it, but the problems of extreme weather due to climate change will always be there. So people are going to have to wake up, even in places like Texas and Florida. You know, the state governments in Texas and Florida don't even recognize climate change. They're not allowed to.
Yeah.
That may be. It may be in the future that I mean, for all we know, the current victory of the far right in the United States could be the last gasp of these people. A lot will depend on how well we can organize ourselves.
Are you worried what are your views on the use of violence today in in America?
I'm very worried about it, because the government and the far right would love to brand the left as terrorists. And so we have to not only be 100% nonviolent, we have to be 150% or 200% nonviolent. Because even, for example, self-defense is construed as violence. So we don't even have the luxury of self-defense.
You don't think there's any place for violence, I guess the word is. There's another element to it is...
Not if our goal is... If our goal is a mass movement for power, then we... I've got to plug in now. Then we have to involve more and more people. We need many more people. Now, in this country, people have been taught over the years that violence that is not perpetrated by the government is either criminal or mentally ill. So we fall into that trap when we use any form of violence, anything that appears to be aggressive. In fact, that's what the government wants. They put agents into demonstrations to create violence. It's the same way in the Soviet Union. I mean, in Russia.
Yeah.
You know, violence delegitimizes us. Even if it's righteous violence, even if it was provoked by the other side, it's pure at best. At best, it's self-expression, and that's it. But it's usually not strategic.
There's a second possibility that
it's stupid. It's just stupid. And a third possibility is that it's cops.
All right. That's a good array of choices.
So I always say to young people, which are you? Are you stupid or are you a cop?
What do you think about the... Sorry, go ahead.
No, it doesn't go over very well.
Right.
They don't like to hear that.
Did I get it correctly from your story back in the 60s and the 70s that the violence that the weatherman used was always targeted at the government and the state agents? And if so, what do you make of what's going on now, where from what I understand, again, the violence is between different groups of citizens? There's the far right and then Antifa.
Well, weather violence tended to be either the state or police or corporations as targets. And for the most part, buildings and not people. But there were some targeting of people, and fortunately, we only killed our own people. But it's especially true. The problem is especially difficult now, in that. Is it okay if I take this call?
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, Randy. Hey, can you hear me? Okay, so do you need me to come? Okay, I'll come down in about an hour, okay? Okay, no problem. I understand. I'm doing this interview now. I'll be off soon. Okay. Righto. Okay. My friend left his keys, and he needs his keys.
All right.
Okay. So I think the Nazis and the government both when we attack them. Because it justifies their violence. So we have to be kind of stake out. We have to stake out the moral position and hold to that moral position. Now, there's some very interesting research has been done lately, especially here in the United States. Have you heard of a political scientist by the name of Erica Chenoweth?
No.
Chenoweth. You might Google her. Erica Chenoweth. She is a quantitative political scientist who studied over 300 struggles, both violent and nonviolent, in the last 50 years throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And they found out that the chances of success of nonviolent struggles are twice as great as violent struggles. So
okay, right.
That's a clear fact, and people are getting and also another interesting conclusion that she and her colleagues have made is that the number of nonviolent struggles is increasing. And the number of violent struggles is decreasing. Now, the specific problem we have in the United States is that the right wing is very well armed.
The left wing
is not very well armed.
That is something that I keep forgetting and reminding myself that the whole situation is different because America has a lot of guns.
There are thousands and thousands of mentally ill right wingers everywhere in the United States who would be willing to murder people for the cause in every city and town in the United States. So it's just plain stupid to engage the Nazis and white supremacists on that battlefield, because we're going to lose. And it's the situation is extremely volatile. Every few weeks, there's a mass murder, mostly by right wingers. Are you familiar with the crazy kid who killed 9 black people in South Carolina? His name is Dylan Roof. In a church.
No, I haven't heard that.
It was last year, a couple years ago, in Charleston, South Carolina. Dylan Roof, R-O-O-F. There are thousands of mentally ill, deranged right wingers in this country. It would be stupid to engage them on the level of violence, because it will quickly escalate to guns, very quickly.
So you're as you're speaking right now, and you're saying deranged right wingers, you seem to be you associate yourself with the side, like the left. And then there are them, the right. Is that correct?
Yes. Racists, white supremacists, Nazis, Confederate diehards. Yeah, there are far right gun nuts. Yes. People who believe Hillary Clinton wanted to take their guns. No,
right.
There are hundreds of millions of guns in this country in the hands of a lot of civilians. Many of them are far right ideologues, yes, and many of them are mentally ill.
Do you feel, I'm trying to get to this one point. I was, before I started talking to you, I had a call with an American friend who was involved for a time with, I guess, the radical left in America a couple of years ago. And she is, you know, following people on Facebook and following the way the landscape changes. And she surprised me by saying that there were, in her own sort of community or social circles, there were numerous cases where somebody who used to be in the Antifa movement, right? So the radical left, punch Nazis type character, after some sort of an altercation with their own group, would completely change and join the exact opposite, the far right group. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you think there's other ways? There are other ways to, like, break the, you know, the population apart into the, there's the left and the right. It's one way to separate these into camps. You could also put all the radical, maybe radical is not the right word, people prone to violence on either of the sides into one camp and try to find some sort of a core that is closer to the middle.
Yeah, like a nonviolent core.
Right.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting theory. The in general, I like to believe that the Antifas are have the same values that I do.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they even have some sort of moral justification for their actions. Namely, you have to stand up to fascism.
Right.
That's the moral justification. I can't completely write those people off and say to those people, you are the same as the Nazis.
Right.
It doesn't quite work that way.
Right.
Right.
You know. Now, there may be some people who go back and forth, you know, but I know these kids and I can't reject them to that level. I can reject them to the level where I can tell them you're either stupid or you're a cop.
All right, that's good enough.
But I can't say that they're the same as the Nazis, you know.
When you were a part of the Weathermen, or later when you're not a part of them, but the organization was still working, did you try to gauge the public's reaction to the bombings?
It's very interesting. There at that time, there were a number of print newspapers, publications that were known as underground newspapers. And they had circulation in the millions all totaled together. Maybe, I don't know, 8 million, 10 million, something like that, out of a population of 200 million, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, generally speaking, oftentimes we would get very good supportive reactions in those newspapers. So that fed us.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, we represented a minority faction of a few million people. And we always justified our small following, relatively speaking, by saying all revolutions start small.
Right.
And they start with defeats, too. So every defeat was rationalized.
Okay. I'm sorry to jump around from one topic to another, but this is one thing that I couldn't also understand in your story. Did I get it correctly that when the Weathermen got power within the SDS, it was like a conscious decision to try and basically dismantle SDS?
Yes.
I write about that completely. Yes. It was stupid. It's the arrogance. There's an arrogance that comes with power. We think that only our ideas are good ideas.
But why did you need to get rid of SDS in order to, like, So there is SDS as a kind of above the ground structure. You can look at them as this is not enough. There needs to be a militant group. Why did you need to dismantle that one in order to continue with your thing?
It's a perfect question. And I've asked myself that many times. At the time, there were many factions within SDS, and we were fighting each other. And we were one faction among many other factions. So it looked to us like the organization was going to explode or blast apart anyway.
So you didn't feel like you're making this action to dismantle it. You're just kind of letting it.
It was both. We did dismantle it, and part of that thinking was that nobody could hold it together. We were going to go underground, and there wasn't anybody left to hold it together. It was crazy thinking. It was totally arrogant, and we also thought that reform or anything short of revolution is a waste of time. For example, there were times when we attacked the anti-war movement as not being revolutionary enough because it only demanded the end of the war. It didn't demand the end of the system. So, so yes, there was a lot of arrogance and self-righteousness and all of this stuff. You know, part of it goes back to the self-expression problem. Part of self-expression is the need to prove how radical and militant I am.
Right.
That doesn't have to do with strategy. Although in a narcissistic way, it sort of does have to do with strategy, because it's a strategy of narcissism that says, I will express myself by punching a Nazi, and my self-expression is very important, because other people will agree with me and will go out and punch Nazis too.
Okay. So how did you, was there like a point or several points in this timeline from Weatherman, the faction within the SDS, to you today, where your thinking changed? Like, you're now saying that you had a stupid theory. When did you first think that that theory was stupid?
There were several points. One was in 1970, within months of my becoming a federal fugitive, where I saw the mass movement of a mass student strike of something up to 4 million students on strike against the war in Vietnam in May of 1970. And I, by that time, was a fugitive, and I couldn't participate. And it struck me that I had made a mistake. But I was very loyal to my comrades and to our ideas, and I carried it through for a while. By about the end of 1970, though, I officially left the organization that I had founded and went out on my own, away from the organization. But I still was a fugitive. By about 1975, when the war ended, that's when I completely recognized that the strategy was a total waste, and I just wanted to come up. But it took me two more years until 1977 when I could turn myself in. 2.5 more years. So. There were points along the way when I speak of it often as coming back to my senses. I really do think that the war in Vietnam, I mean, let me put it this way. When you realize that your country is murdering millions of people, it's not always obvious what the right thing to do is.
Right. Yeah, okay. That's a good way of putting it. And then is there, so you got rid or overgrown an ideology that you used to have back then. Did another ideology developed, or did you accept another ideology, or are you trying to stay away from those generally?
In general, I try to be as little ideological as possible. For example, I don't think that there's any kind of predetermined mechanism by which consciousness is, you know, class consciousness exists or anything like that. But but I do kind of like, as models, the Scandinavian social democracy. I don't think that the world has done too much better. And, you know, although those are homogeneous societies, and they tend to be small, I still call myself a social democrat. But if somebody can show me a better way, I'll go for that.
All right. And so your current, just wrapping this up, I'm trying to think, you had an understanding of what is to be done back then. And now you're looking for what, ways to reform the Democratic Party?
I work on two levels. One is I push the momentum-driven movement, say on climate change, on water issues here, on racism, on the government's clampdown on immigrants. These are all issue-oriented movements, and they benefit from a certain amount of momentum. So on the one hand, I push that, and I try to train young organizers in the idea of strategic organizing, of figuring out goals and how to build a movement. The marker for success, this refers to something you asked before, is numbers. How many people do we have at demonstrations? How many people are joining? How many people are we growing in numbers? Then the second area is the Democratic Party. Transforming the Democratic Party into a social democratic party, and that's different kind of work, and usually it's different people are involved in that. So that's the two areas I'm working in.
Is there a way to summarize a strategy for reforming the Democratic Party, or is that too complicated to?
No, it can be summarized. The party has to represent, the government has a responsibility for the well-being of the planet and the people, the majority of the people, not just the wealthy. That's all. And in the United States, the dominant ideas at present are government is bad and free markets are good, but those are ridiculous. That's ridiculous. We need government, and government has to be remade. So that's how I try to explain it to people.
But is there a strategy? Like, are you saying that Democratic Party should have new members that have different ideas to the ones that have, I mean, members, by members, I mean like people who are trying to get elected into one office or another, or you try to...
The vast majority of public opinion is in the United States is always for what are called progressive solutions, like, for example, universal health care, free public higher education. These are progressive solutions that probably 60% or more of the population supports, but the population does not vote. Only a few people vote. Less than half of all the possible voters vote, and most of them are highly, a lot of people have given up, or right, they're distracted, right, or they're not paying attention. So the goal then is to repoliticize the country. You know, it's interesting. They say that at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union in 1991, you had a society that was highly depoliticized. People lived their own lives, their real lives, not politically.
Sure. Right?
It's the same way here. It's the exact same way here. People don't lead their real lives here. Here, their real lives have to do with work, getting drunk, beating their wives, sex, football. That's their real lives, not elections. That's why Obama got elected, because he gave people hope. Trump got elected because he was something different.
Right. Well, then, so that's my question. If people are so tired of the old Democratic and Republican parties, how do you change the Democratic Party in such a way that people are not just bored by it and actually have some interest in its fate?
Let's see, I'm 70 years old. I think I'll have that one answered by about the time I'm 110. It took the far right 50 years, actually more than 50 years, for the far right to organize to the point where they've gained power. I think we can do it quicker, but I think it'll be 20 to 40 years.
So okay.
You've put your finger on exactly what we need to do. How to do it? I try to work on it every day with people to try to figure it out, but we still don't have that solution. Nobody trusts Democratic politicians, but it's very interesting. A lot of people trusted Bernie Sanders. You know, it was kind of interesting how many people, young people, got excited about Bernie Sanders, and when he said, "I'm a Democratic Socialist," that didn't bother them. They had no memory of socialism. They don't know anything. So, you know, Democratic Socialist, that sounds good. You know, you got to stay hopeful. I don't have the solution, but that's what I'm working on. Is exactly what you said.
Hey, thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much for this.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Same here.
Next time you're in Albuquerque, come see me. Yeah, well, dos vidania.
Dos vidania. Thank you.
Dos vidania. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.